Hello and welcome back to the London Magazine podcast. I'm Jamie Cameron, managing editor here at the magazine, and I'm joined by Zadie Loft, our editorial and marketing assistant. Zadie, hello.
Hello.
We're also delighted to be joined by poet and editor Paul Stevenson to discuss his debut collection that has been shortlisted for the Plowrey Book Prize this year, Hard Drive. The poems in Hard Drive navigate the aftermath of loss with tenderness and insight, and also heaps of craft and consideration of form as well. They chronicle the emotional and physical journeys of grief, from the practical tasks of mourning through to the intimate encounters with those who guide us through it. Some of these poems have really, really stuck with me, Paul, and I'm very excited to mention that the London Magazine will be publishing some work of yours in the not-too-distant future, of course, also maybe different in tone from this book. But for now, thank you so much for joining us, and how are you?
Good morning. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm fine, thanks.
Great. Before we get on to discussing the collection itself, I wanted to ask a bit about the locality of these poems and indeed your life right now. I know that you've lived in London, you've lived in Cambridge, you've lived in Paris. You're speaking to us on Zoom from Brussels right now. I saw it mentioned that you are somewhat of a Eurostar frequent traveller. So I wanted to ask how many of the poems, indeed in this collection, and your poems more broadly, are written while you're on trains or while travelling? Is that somewhere that you like to write?
That is a really good question. Yeah, I love being on the move, that sense of freedom, being in between places and, you know, immersing yourself in a poem. You know, you can get from London to Brussels without blinking an eyelid. Suddenly you're there. Working on a poem or reading a poetry collection. Yeah, high-speed trains have been really important for me for the last 20 years. And that carte blanche that I have to not have to queue for the Eurostar is worth its weight in gold, I can tell.
Oh, is that a thing? I didn't realise that.
Yeah. Free alcohol, obviously, in the business lounge, but to not have to queue, yeah.
It is definitely the most elegant and pleasurable way to travel around Europe.
Chic,
it is very chic indeed, yeah.
Totally. And there are a couple of poems in the book. I mean, like the St. Pancras poem and the Grief is Northern French Landscape. But yeah, it's high-speed trains, Eurostar.
Great then. Well, to start off the podcast, it'd be great if you could read us a few of the poems from this collection, please.
Shall do. With pleasure. So I'm going to read, first of all, the preface poem to the book, which is called Anglepoise. The book was nearly called Anglepoise, but I went with Hard Drive in the end. Maybe we can discuss why. But yeah, this is the preface poem, which I think sets up the whole book. And then I'll read two or three more. Anglepoise. You'll be in the front room at your computer, surrounded by your family of Anglepoise lamps. The novel will be making steady progress. I'll be in the kitchen with my laptop and radio, editing some poem or other, devoting an hour to the question of a comma, semicolon, full stop. Voices will drift up to me from where you are. My drama will drift down the hallway to you. There'll be hot radiators and rugs, curtains drawn. We'll both be home, absorbed in our projects, each working our way through the bottle of red. I'll be alive. You'll be alive. It'll be like old times. The thesis. It was June and I had to see a student. A Tuesday morning and I had to see several students. I knew something was wrong. I called and asked a friend for help. I was far away and I had to see a student. She said she'd go round and ring the bell. I tried to listen to the mouth of the student. He or she was seeking my approval. I knew something was wrong. It was June, and I was seeing a student. I gave some useful advice. I gave a smile. I knew something was wrong. I wished them well, saw off the student. The deadline was approaching for submitting the thesis. It was late morning, and I had to see a student. I sat across from a student, faced the thesis, and then across from another student. I waited for my friend's call. My friend was in London. I knew something wasn't right. I worked my way through the students. Signature. In his sleep, except he isn't really sleeping, that's just what we like to tell ourselves, he looks as if he's grinning, as if he knows something new. Seen a sight to comfort him and offer reassurance so he can close his eyes for good. Or else he's understood once and for all what us lot don't, that this here is one massive joke, some lame farce from the beginning. I wouldn't be surprised because he had his own sense of humour, black in the mishaps and embarrassment, saw the human comedy, relishing the doddering and stumbling of others, their sticky situations, how they keep on talking, words making it worse, digging a hole for themselves. I look at his mouth and he's not saying much, but keeping stumm, lip sealed, mum's the word. And I'm positive, 100%, that he won't tell me what's tickling him, not this time. I edge up, lean in and steep over. Allow myself to touch his forehead, lay my palm flat on the long fringe, and with my thumb caress each fine brow, stroke them in the right direction. Feel the love, cold and wet, from refrigeration. Collecting you from Golders Green. The young woman, lady, female, behind the desk, counter, reception, spoke gently, softly, calmly, seemed genuinely moved, emotional, upset, and I thought, how generous, kind, ridiculous, for she never knew, met, was acquainted with you. She checked her screen, monitor, computer, and vanished, took her leave, was gone. I sat on the sofa, couch, settee, looking, staring, glancing around the office, at the pot plant, cheese plant, cactus, until she came back. Returned, reappeared. She was holding, carrying, balancing a large, sizable, ample brown container, receptacle, cardboard box, neatly, immaculately, pristinely sealed, with your name, surname, identifier, on a white label, sticker, square, in jet black. I got in the car, vehicle, motor, and sat, positioned, placed you safely on my knees, legs, lap, I felt the weight, pounds, load of you. As Jean drove, escorted, chauffeured me away to Highgate, to hers, home. The hymn of him. The app of him, the bop of him, the cap, the cop of him, the cup of him, the dip, the fop of him, the gap of him, the hip, the hop of him, the jip of him, the lap. The lip of him, the map of him, the mop, the nap of him, the nip of him, the pep. The pip of him, the pup of him, the quip, the rap of him, the rep of him, the rip. The sap of him, the sip of him, the sup, the tap of him, the tip of him, the top, the VIP of him, the whip of him, the yap, the yep of him, the zap of him, the zip. The ship of him, the shop of him, the shut up. The chap of him, the chip of him, the chop.
Thank you. I guess as a place to start, Jamie's already mentioned that this collection was written after your long-term partner died quite suddenly. But in that opening poem of the collection that you just read for us, Anglepoise, that tragedy is almost erased by the future conditional tense of those last few lines. I'll be alive, you'll be alive, it'll be like old times. I wanted to ask if the process of writing this collection, these poems, was healing or helpful in processing your grief? You know, what was it like to exist in that future conditional space of those lines and those poems in general?
It was certainly therapeutic. I mean, in retrospect, I probably should have had some therapy or something. But you know the cliche about poetry, you know, write it out. So that's what you do. It's a place to go to. I mean, when he's sitting on your shoulder, basically, the whole time, and every time you do a writing workshop or you're discussing a poem and writing in response with friends, of course, you're channeling that grief. And so, yeah, it was extremely useful. I mean, I don't know what I would have done without having poetry in my life. It was extremely important. And it was a way of processing the past, holding on to the past, and a little bit like a collaboration, in a sense, a collaboration with the deceased. You could even argue it's the continuation of a relationship in a sense, because it's hard to let go of grief and loss and bereavement. It's a place to stay, isn't it? It's a place to not necessarily wallow, but certainly a space in which, yeah, you revisit the past and, yeah, you think about the conditionals. What if, I'll be alive, you'll be alive. It'll be like old times. It's very simple, but it has quite an impact.
It's been, what, 6 or 7 years in the making, this collection, right? So the last thing you released before this was 2016, am I right in saying that? One of your pamphlets. Does it feel, after all this time has passed, grief is not something that ever really stops happening. So it doesn't feel like you've released it and then, okay, that's a part of my life that I've been able to process. Things, I presume, are not, don't feel that simple.
No, I mean, it's not like all the loose ends are tied up. I still have lots of storage, for example. I still have, you know, my relationship with his parents in America to negotiate and the friends left behind. And I think processing all of that, turning all the pain into something beautiful that will have posterity, that will live on, is part of the healing process, you know, to produce the best possible book you could produce, to take risks and experiment with the poems, and to produce something that maybe he would think was, yeah, okay, not bad. it was a challenge to myself, actually, also because, you know, do we need another book of poems around death and loss and bereavement? There are lots of them out there. So it was a challenge, wasn't it? A sort of artistic challenge to try to do something that's different and unique. And there were surprises, obviously, along the way. I didn't realize I would end up writing poems about all these incredible professionals you meet along the way. You mentioned that in the introduction. So in a sense, it ended up being very much a book about people, a book about the living, a book about friendship and those left behind.
Speaking of the risks and the sense of experimenting, I'm really interested in what recourse the form of the poems offered when you were writing about painful life experiences. Was form and the constraint that they offered something that you relied on as a kind of like scaffolding for the feelings to sit alongside? Was it something you were kind of using to integrate? Is that a way that you look at form? Because people have described you as a formalist, but I don't think it's as simple as that, right?
Well, I was going to use the word scaffolding. Yeah. I think that's definitely right.
I stole that off. I think that's a Michael Donaghy line. So I think I
think it? Okay, yeah. I love using constraints, Oulipian constraints, or I mean, I had poems and adventures in form that penned in the Margins anthology from a decade ago. And I did experiment with form in the other pamphlets. And I think a lot of the games that I played and the devices I used in those three pamphlets, I probably honed that and applied it to now a very serious subject matter, whereas there was perhaps more humour and lightheartedness in the other poems. Well, certainly not the pamphlet on the Paris attacks, but maybe the first and third pamphlets. But yeah, I think form, it's like having a menu, isn't it? A restaurant. Which form can I use or abuse? You know, it's good to know the forms, but also play around with them a little bit and be a bit more subversive, perhaps. So yeah, I think it's also important, isn't it, to keep it fresh, keep it exciting as you turn the page. The shape of the poem is different. The form of the poem is different. The containers, you know. So yeah, I can't say I set out ever to write a sonnet or write a pantoum or whatever, but you know, as you're writing, you're questioning, what does the poem want to be? Where is this going? Where is it pushing towards?
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine as someone who has to do some typesetting for the London magazine that people at Carcanet must have had a whale of a time trying to lay out all the different types of structures of poems, whether that's landscape across the page, smaller
fonts. Oh my goodness, do you know how long this took and how many PDFs?
I can't, honestly, Paul, I can't even imagine, yeah.
It's a traditional book size, yeah, but actually there are quite a few poems with long lines and I wanted them to be produced exactly as they were in the magazines. So that meant we had to take some difficult decisions, whether or not you reduce the font size by 0.5 or by 1 point, whether you put the poems vertically, you know, sideways on, which we've done in a couple of cases. For example, I have a poem where I use an aphora and the word water appears at the end of every single line, sometimes in jammed, sometimes end stopped. But it was really important that that appeared as a block and that the visual game was there. So I was worried that I really pissed them off. After saying, no, this is still not right. Can we please look at this again? And then I changed the order of poems a couple of times. But I hope as a result, it's very varied. You know, it's visually interesting. I wanted there to be variation in form, in shape. And I also, of course, wanted there to be variation in emotional response. I didn't want a book that was completely sad and sorrowful and you were conditioned as a reader from page one. I wanted every time you read a poem to have to, again, negotiate, what's my emotional response? Is this funny? Is this absurd? Is this angry? You know, how do I respond to this?
Is there a poem in this collection that particularly resisted that negotiation and you really had to kind of grind out formally? Because in Anglepoise, you have that line about devoting an hour to the question of a comma or a semicolon or a full stop. So you don't strike me as someone who writes a poem in an afternoon and then doesn't revisit it again. So there must have been some that were perhaps even year-long endeavours.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they say put the poem in the drawer and come back to it afresh. Yeah, there's a lot of precision to these poems, I would say, certainly. Because obviously I've lived with them for a long time. A lot of them, most of them actually had been in magazines. And so I was revisiting them again. You know, you've printed it, you've published it in a magazine, so you've kind of abandoned the poem. But then you revisit it again and maybe reconsider, yeah, the shape on the page. I was also very conscious of the left and right pages. When I was laying out, I really wanted to ensure that left and right, there was variation in shape and that visually it was interesting. And so that there was sometimes symmetry. And that sometimes, yeah, they're a little bit sculptural. I use forward slashes or use, you know, instead of commas, white space, a little bit like Andrew McMillan does. Or in Better Verbs for Scattering, you know, having poems that sort of appear like cascades, stepped poems, yeah.
It's quite nice when you look at the acknowledgements at the back of the book. But it's basically a who's who of the most relevant poetry journals in the UK. But each of them have their own, you know, like a Bad Lilies poem will be different to a poem in Poetry Wales, for example. And the way you describe how they look, there's also the sense of capturing UK poetry at large through both the journals and through the poems themselves.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there's a long list of magazines and anthologies there. And of course, that's only the poems that got published. Of course, many of them were rejected several times.
In poems like Condolences with two Ds, Your Name and Collecting You from Golders Green, which you read for us, there's a somewhat playful, absurdist approach to language, which I think the word absurd has already surfaced. You know, some of them you're tracing etymologies, using rhyme, wordplay, and there comes a point in some of the poems where I felt that the words lost all meaning. And there's an Alice Notley quote, which I quite like, where she says, "I feel ambivalent about words. I know they don't work. I know they aren't it." And I wondered if at times writing and words felt limiting or absurd when exploring grief. Were there some emotions that the words just couldn't quite reach?
Certainly. I mean, I do play around, you know, the condolences poem you mentioned, playing around with any words that have double Ds, yeah. You know, because the name was T-O-D, not T-O-D-D, playing with the kind of annoyance of that when people got it wrong. It ends up with some kind of weird portrait of me at the end, quite absurd. But yeah, I think, for example, there's this Starkitect poem towards the end of the book where I use all the words that went into the Oxford English Dictionary in 2016, well, a selection of them, and I don't know what most of them mean, but I use them in this poem that's a little bit Ordenesque, a bit like Stop All the Clocks, He Was My ABC, you know, I go through all these words and we make our own meaning from that. We don't really know what a bish bash bosh or a Bodhi tree or a glamping jackalope is or a crop lamellophone, but he was all of those, you know. So we find our own sense. And there's a kind of absurdist music there. And then I think that poem that I have, Better Verbs for Scattering, that I mentioned earlier, to scatter was just such an inadequate word. Mm. It's such a prissy word almost, to scatter seed on a field. But if you've ever tried to dispose of someone's ashes, it's extremely arduous, very heavy, hard work, you're battling with the elements. Someone's like, scatter? Mm. You don't scatter ashes. I mean, they blow in your face and all over your clothes. And so that was an opportunity to invent language, to dizzy wind the ashes, to kind release the ashes, to rock set the ashes, you know, to just play with language, neologisms, but also weave in names of authors, composers, philosophers that he liked. So I was kind of weaving him into the poem and making those names into verbs. It's about having a bit of fun, isn't it?
I mean, the hymn of him is another great example of that, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, you have a background in linguistics. I know that you're a foreign language speaker, you speak French, have lived there. I get the impression that you're someone who thinks about language beyond just the kind of denotative meaning or even the connotative meaning. Like you're thinking several layers deep in terms of sound, in terms of literal meaning.
Yeah, that poem in particular is a wonderful constraint because you've got a certain number of three-letter words ending in P. And when you put them all together like that, it kind of creates its own narrative, even though it's just a list poem and a song. Some of the meanings are obvious and some of them you have to think about. And then suddenly there's that chap of him, the chip of him, the chop. Again, this surprise kind of emotional landing for the poem that you don't even expect. And these words are all just alphabetical. They're actually simply A to Z. And then the sher-cher at the end. What does it reveal? It's a complete surprise to me. You know, this idea of surprises as a writer, surprises as a reader. Mm. But yeah, linguistics has been important to me. And also I think learning modern languages, you know, thinking across languages, you know, if you see P-A-I-N, it's pain or it's pun.
Yeah.
So often seeing other words within words.
How does that emerge on a practical level when you're, that poem specifically, how did you go about experimenting? Was it just a case of almost, you know, sliding different words in different places and reading it out loud?
I really can't remember, to be honest.
Was that a Eurostar poem? Were you in the kind of the business lounge reading
yeah,
that
possibly,
out? And people,
possibly. You do something quickly, you know. I think actually I was thinking about the title. It started with the title. The fact that they are, what's the word, homophones?
Homophones, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the same sound but spelt differently. And that's where I started. I thought the hymn of him. Okay, I like that.
It's all kind of, it's Whitman-esque.
It's him.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess also alongside the absurdity and the play with words, there is humour in this collection. As you said, there's a range of tones and there are references to Justin Bieber and Louis XVI and everything that comes in between those two figures. And you've called the collection a soap opera of bereavement in a different interview. So what did you want the reader to take from these moments of humour, or what role did humour have in an otherwise quite tender and sincere collection?
I've always been attracted to sort of absurdist poetry. I mean, Luke Kennard is a poet who's gave me a lot of permission to write.
And he has a poem after him written in his collection.
Yeah, your novel, yeah, after my friend.
Which is, it sounds so much like the ones out of the Notes on the Sonnets. It's very of that style. It's great.
Yeah, and that gave me a palimpsest almost to write from. And the free Spotify poem you mentioned, I think that's probably the most difficult poem in the book because it's quite complicated what happened to convey that in a poem, to be listening and his voice coming on and thinking, that sounds like Martin Luther King. How can it be Martin Luther King? I'm listening to Justin Bieber, and then ending up on Google and researching something and then being totally sort of transported somewhere and then finding yourself back again, staring out the window at the moon, you know. So there's an absurdity there, of course. I think it's important, you know, again, bereavement, grief, it's extremely self-indulgent. I think also, you know, you can be sad and sorrowful, but you risk with poetry, I think, landing up at some uber sincerity that's so over-egged.
I think there's a great quote, which is that you don't need to be sentimental in a poem because a poem is already sentimental, right?
Yeah. Actually, I think the most sentimental and the poetic poems come from the boring, ordinary, domestic day-to-day. That's where you really find the emotion.
The scenes that explore explicitly that banality, you know, the administrative side, the awkward conversations, the specific language of bureaucracy, and there's the one that plays around with satisfaction surveys. Is that something that you played around with in your pamphlets before? Was that a novel approach specifically for this collection as you encountered these characters in the soap opera of bereavement?
Well, you know, my first pamphlet, Those People, that was won the poetry business competition, judged by Billy Collins. There is a poem in there called Angle End, which is the street I grew up on in the village I grew up in. And it basically lists everybody, all the kind of weird, eccentric characters you find in your village. Because I remember thinking at the time, starting out, oh, I just grew up in a Cambridgeshire village. What's interesting about that? Someone like Peter and Anne Sampson, you know, who the poetry business, they make you realise that, God, everything is interesting and exotic and particular to you. And so just cataloguing all your strange neighbours, in a way, Mr. and Mrs. Pagan and their great Dane Solomon, always mowing their many acres of lawn, but not using them for anything, even running on. Or the Ablett shaped like a ball who lived inside the boarded up Sunday school. Or that fascination with people and individuals is something that probably runs through all my work. And certainly the Paris pamphlet is also about people, individuals who are caught up in that.
That feels like quite a UK and Irish poetry preoccupation. I think there's a sense in America that they're a bit happier to kind of speak with an eye that represents everyone in a way that UK and Irish poets feel a bit more queasy about. Is that, do you think that's fair?
I'd say that's fair, yeah.
not to cause the kind of poetry wars to reemerge, but anyway, sorry, go on.
I wanted to ask about the more logistical side of a poetry collection, particularly in terms of structure and ordering the poems. For a collection about something as sprawling as grief, and you've mentioned you're sort of bringing in all these characters and there's variation in tone, how did you find ordering the poems and finding a narrative thoroughfare through them? What was the editing process like?
Well, I put together the manuscript and it was in 5 parts, actually, not 6 originally. It just seemed to be logical to have these clusters of poems. I mean, putting together a pamphlet of 25, 30 pages is one thing. And even that, you need those kind of flagstone poems and then the arcs to hammock between major poems. And here I thought, well, this is a massive endeavor to actually put a book together. Never thought it would be 128 pages as opposed to the usual 60 pages of a collection. But then you can't contain grief to 60 pages necessarily. So I tried to cluster the poems in terms of episodes as a way of trying to think about structure, and ended up here with these 5 parts. The first 3 parts looking at both the immediate aftermath of the death, death admin and bureaucracy, and then, you know, objects emptying an apartment. And then that second half of the book that ended up actually in 6 parts, going back to revisit the relationship, going back in time. And then a 6th part that actually explores what it is to write grief, knowing your poems are going to go out into the world, that consciousness of the poet and the kind of ethical and legitimate questions you have about what you're doing, commodifying grief and death in something that will be sold. I thought originally that the book would probably just be the first 3 parts, and that maybe I'd have a second collection that was a prequel that would go back in time. But I think talking to friends, they said, no, we need to know more about the two of you. We need to know more about that early relationship, what it is to be in a long-term relationship, cohabitation and all of that. And that's starting out, those first encounters. So that's what happened, and it ended up in 6 parts. And I think for people that don't normally read poetry, that's probably helpful. I mean, when I do readings and I start with that kind of quite dramatic opening, it sets up a story.
The sixth part is actually my favourite, I think. And
is
I think the writing to your mother poem is, I think, my favourite poem in the collection as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's interesting that it only emerged, when you say at the last minute, it wasn't in the original manuscript sent to Carcanet.
I think it may have been earlier on, but I thought, actually, there are a few poems here that are doing certain things and should go together. And so I may have moved a few things around, and I thought this deserves its own section, you know, particularly with putting it out there, the poem where I'm playing with the whole idea of what will a book look like and what will the numbers in the ISBN be. And
yeah.
And then, of course, I had that big poem, Your Brain, which was, I thought it was too risk-taking at the beginning to include in the collection, so I put it in the reserve. And John McAuliffe said, no, you need to bring that one in. So, yeah, the writing to your mother poem, it was something I had to confront very early on. You know, when I write an email to her, do I have to specifically mention your name every time? Or can we have a conversation that doesn't make reference to your death? Do we exist in our own right, in our own lives, without always having to mention your name?
Yeah, that's the meta element almost of, you know, you're writing a letter to the mother while also writing a poem about writing. I think that's what I like about that last section.
The things you have to grapple with as a writer, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. And then this book is, of course, nominated for the Polari Prize. Congratulations. And that's a prize dedicated to books that explore the LGBTQ+ experience. How much did the specifics of queerness in grieving come through? Was that a theme you were aware of as you were writing? Or is that something separate that the Polari Prize has then picked up?
I'm really honoured to be shortlisted for the Polari Prize. I'm up against, I think, four novelists and a very established cartoonist. So it's fantastic. It's a real honour, you know, the fact that these poems have shone through. But the whole question of queerness, I'm not sure, to be honest. I had reservations even about marketing or labelling the collection as a gay or queer or LGBT book. In my biography as a poet, I'd never put I'm an LGBT poet for the first three pamphlets. So I was unsure. But by the time, you know, the book was accepted by Carcanet and we were thinking about marketing, I was like, well, the more the merrier. Let's yeah. It's an LGBT book. I'm a gay man. This is the story of a gay relationship, a long-term relationship. So let's go for it. But other people have said to me, but why is it being branded or marketed or promoted as a gay book when there's nothing particularly gay or queer about it in their eyes? Because indeed, it's the story of a relationship. Mm. There's nothing very sexualized, or there's not much reference to the body, which perhaps one might argue is often indicative of gay queer poetry or literature. And in that sense, I do, you know, it's important to me that the book speaks to anybody who has experienced loss or who has been in a long-term relationship. So it's a good question you ask. And when I did the online launch, actually, Gregory Woods, the professor of LGBT literature at Nottingham, you know, one of the most prolific gay poets in the country and most established, asked me to what extent does this fall within the tradition of gay poetry? And I really didn't know how to answer. I thought that maybe the gayness, the queerness is more the humour, the perspective, the kind of jokes or the way I look at the world, the sensibility or aesthetic.
I mean, there's definitely an Auden-esque thing going on. I think that's maybe his version of queerness is contained within the similar aspect to what you just described. It's interesting. And I think you talk about bring on the marketing schemes, whatever, you know, if this can be tied to it in some way, then great. And I think there's a similar sense to the title being, you can take that title in a million different ways, right?
Oh, you could.
And I think that is what makes it such a great title. And you said earlier that Anglepoise was potentially going to be the title first. I think Hard Drive is a much better title, if you don't mind me saying that, because, I mean, I don't want to kind of just set you up to list the 15 different subtexts that the title has. But I am interested in how you ended up there and why there was that change.
I think it was Hard Drive. A friend suggested Anglepoise. I thought Anglepoise was too poised. Some people maybe don't know what an Anglepoise lamp is even. But Hard Drive, I felt, was a media. It was these great, strong, short words, that hard consonant, the duh. And obviously, most immediately, it refers to the hardware, you know, all the files and the images and the videos on a hard drive in a storage unit. But yeah, the hard drive of a long-term relationship, the hard drive to the mortuary, to the crematorium, the hard drive of dealing with a death. But as you're suggesting, yeah, it could also be the hard drive of being hard, of passion, of sex, of being driven, of lust. Yeah, definitely. So I think it's a good title. I agree in that it's got many meanings, many interpretations.
What struck me when preparing for this podcast is that the answer to all of these questions is in the poems. You know, there's questions of sequencing that we've asked, the questions of narrative, of negotiation and form and permission and bureaucracy and all these things you explore. It seems like almost every conceivable aspect thematically of death and grief is pored over, but then explored within the texts themselves. And one, it makes it for a very interesting interview because every single kind of question you can ask is kind of already covered in one of the poems. You can almost read a poem in response. So what I am tempted to ask is that, is there anything that you feel you did not manage to do justice to? Is there an angle that you've been asked about perhaps in the promotion of this book where you thought, I hadn't thought about that? Is there some part of your grief that you either couldn't or didn't want to take on or thematicize in the poems?
There may well be. There are things I think I've shied away from, certainly, to do with ambiguities around his death. But I thought you have to keep some things back. Okay, I'm turning a lot of personal pain into something hopefully beautiful, something universal. And some of the tensions, obviously, in a long-term relationship, I don't dwell on too much. You've got to be conscious also of your readers, who's going to read this book. So there's some self-restraint, I suppose, which is probably a good thing.
To move on from that in a linear way, as it were, the next book, have you started writing the poems for it? Have you thought about it? Is it going to be something that is tied so closely to a particular life event in the way that this one is?
This book was actually a second manuscript. I actually went to Carcanet, had the submissions window, submitted two manuscripts. One was a sort of best of my writing called Auto Routes, which was, again, clustered around work, travel, Europe, sexuality, love. And then I put this book together and Carcanet said that they felt this was the most original and the most important, the two manuscripts. So now I'm sort of faced with the conundrum is I have a lot of uncollected work and not necessarily in the pamphlets. What do I do with it all? How does it speak to this book? Because it's really now, I think John McAuliffe, my editor, said, whatever you do next really has to speak to hard drive. It has to speak to the poet who's gone through bereavement, grief and loss and is moving on in their life. So I have been playing around. I've been experimenting with algorithms on WhatsApp. I've been using captions, you know, misrendered through live transcripts. I've been playing around a little bit with material and techniques. But I think the poems that I'm writing at the moment, including the one that you're going to I'm very lucky to have it featured in a future issue of a London magazine, is exploring the complexity of modern relationships, what it is to be together and to be separate. Maybe if I can use this term, situationships. Commitment or lack of commitment. I think things have changed drastically in terms of dating and in terms of love and romance since I met my partner who features in this book. So I wanted to explore those tensions. I mean, that's what I'm doing. And I've got quite a lot of poems so far that explore these themes.
I mean, sometimes to make a comparison with music, you often see someone will release a concept album, if you want to use that term, and then the album that they follow up with will just be really kind of straight shooting and just these are my best songs / best poems.
Yeah.
There must be a temptation to do that as well.
There is a temptation, yeah. And I think what I will do is cherry pick some of those earlier poems about maybe infatuation and bring them in. Because there are poems I'm really fond of that have been in magazines, but probably they're lost. They're out there somewhere, and I'd like to bring them together. So try to kind of combine some of those early poems from the last few years and then bring together this new body of work. Yeah, you can go out and find love, but it's not necessarily as easy as you expect, at least in my experience. So I think that's something I will explore. And I've been reading poets like Carl Phillips recently, his books by Carcanet that have spoken to me and given me a way in. Ali Lewis, another poet.
Yeah, Last Meal, that poem, which is really getting at what you're talking about relationships, is one of the best poems I've read this year. It's unbelievable.
And then as a final question, we like to ask all of our guests what they've been enjoying recently. So whether that's an album, film, book, artwork, one of each, if you like, tell us what you've been loving recently.
Wow, that's a difficult question. I've read so many books. Every time I go to Bridge, I fill my trolley suitcase with all the books and magazines, and they sit here unread, piling up. Yeah, as I say, the Carl Phillips recent collection, Scattered Snow, I've really enjoyed. I've been reading Clotilde de Tunge's new book, Emotional Support Horse. What else?
So outside of the world of poetry, is the only media you consume metered?
Art collections. I've been to the Gulbenkian recently in Lisbon. That was really good. I've been very much involved with Poetry in Aldborough. I think that's been what's taking up a lot of my time. We just held the festival in Suffolk. in November. So that's been fascinating to hear the new work of poets I enjoy, like Matt Howard, his new book, Broadlands by Bloodaxe, which is absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. Just some admin. You can find The London Magazine on Instagram at The London Mag, on Twitter at The London Mag as well, and also Blue Sky as well now too. I mean, let's see how well that announcement ages. You can also subscribe to the magazine for just £40 a year. That's 6 print issues to your door for £40. And if you'd like, you can order our new December-January issue, which is available now. And then, Paul, your poems will be appearing sometime in the new year, so people should prepare themselves to read that too. Zadi, thank you so much. Paul, thank you so much for talking to us about this collection. We really, really enjoy it. Can I be very cheeky and ask if you'll read us out with the Writing to Your Mother poem?
Sure, by all means. And thank you so much for inviting me to speak to you today. It's been a real pleasure. Your questions really, really made me think. Writing to Your Mother. Whenever I sit down to write to your mother, there's the question of you. And whenever you come into my head, there's the decision to be made whether or not to mention your name. Whenever I go to mention your name, it's another reminder you've gone. And whenever your goneness seems violent and I recall your mother will be reading my words, I search for something more upbeat. Whenever I start searching for what's upbeat, I end up mining for a funny episode, an anecdote, falling back on your silliness. And see your mother's eyes passing over my words, her mouth turning up at the edges. Whenever your mother's mouth turns up at the edges, she's using the many muscles it takes to smile. And in the process, that small smile may fool her into thinking she's living a moment of happiness.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Paul. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.